Welcome to the Brand 50 Podcast, where we interview entrepreneurs of all types that have started their businesses later in life. Learn, be inspired, and get motivated from their stories so that you can take your life's experiences and turn them into your next venture. Here are your hosts, Jack Uhaldi and Robert Erie Artboard.
Great interview, Jack, with Dr. Stanley Jacobs, a true Renaissance man, isn't he?
He really is, Rob. But more than that, he's just a really great guy. I've got to know Stanley over the course of 10 plus years now. I helped him with his advertising early on. Just really appreciate him as a professional, but also as a human being. He's just a really, really good guy. He's a plastic surgeon, but more than that, he really is an artist. He's taken his craft and really applied art. These are his words, not mine. He's really into art history, language, and just sculpting, and that really has come through not only with this interview that I just did with him, but also the video that we did earlier this year.
And as though being a plastic surgeon wasn't enough, he took it to a different level at around age 50, didn't he?
He did. You know, it's amazing because he's got such a busy schedule. He works part-time out of Healdsburg, California, then he's in San Francisco, and it's a two-hour commute either way. He's taken it to a new level. He's fully engaged in his practice, but above and beyond the practice, he started at around age 50, a skincare line, and had to go get investors, had to invest his own money into the skincare line, had to get it manufactured. He's having to deal with the marketing aspects of it all. It's a lot of work, but again, it's a passion and something that he knows a lot about.
And we'll hear it in the interview when you talk about his love for Egyptian art and how that turned into the skincare line.
He took a lot out of, he really dug deep into Egyptian art, went back to Egypt several times with his family, really embraced it, and utilized his knowledge of Egyptian history to help his skincare line. Sounds crazy, but he actually applied something he learned into a business. Let's listen. I'm here with Dr. Stanley Jacobs, triple board certified plastic surgeon, a husband. How long have you been married?
27 years.
It's good that you remember that. So married 27 years, you've got two kids, you've got a thriving practice as a plastic surgeon here in your practices in Healdsburg and also in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We've known each other for quite some time now. I've always been impressed by you, not only as a professional working doctor, but also as a person, a husband, a father. You know, I've got to get to know you and your family and really put you in high regard. And it's one of the reasons why you are my first podcast here. Thanks for taking the time to do this.
Sure.
Before we get into some more in-depth questions, tell me a little bit more about yourself. Like, what's your passion? What drives you above and beyond being a doctor and a husband and a father? What are the other things that our listeners might want to know about you?
I'm interested in history. I'm interested in art history and art in general. I like that. I mean, we travel a lot, so I like to travel. I speak some French, grew up in Montreal, so I like languages. I learn a little bit of languages when we travel. Before we go traveling, even when the kids are small, we'd put a CD in the car and listen to, whether it was, you know, Greek or Turkish or whatever, and I think that was always kind of fun to travel and to learn about other cultures. So that's something that I've always enjoyed, and when I'm there, I study their art, their history firsthand, and eventually actually in my own practice, and I occasionally give a lecture called Beauty, the Arts, and Facial Aesthetic Surgery, because they're so inextricably interwoven. It's something that I really like, because I'm a big believer in cross-pollinization of ideas. It's important to whatever field you're in is to think about other things that would help that endeavor to make it more interesting for yourself and make it sort of more depth to your knowledge.
Excellent. You know, and I know, and we'll get into it a little bit later, but I know your fascination with Egyptian history, right, okay, led to a discovery, which you have as a business, as part mm-hmm. of your business. But on the surface, you've got a successful life going, beautiful home, a great practice, wonderful family. But you also had struggles along mm-hmm. the line. You know, you had to put yourself through school. Mm-hmm. You know, you had some loans. You had, there were hardships to a certain level. But tell us a little bit about some of the struggles you had getting to where you are now, and some of the things you had to overcome.
Well, I mean, we're from Canada, and then trained in Canada mainly. Then we came here in '89 in the States to do an extra year of teaching. After doing all the training I did in medical school and undergrad, internship, and residency, people thought I was crazy to do another year. But one of my professors told me, you know, Stan, I don't think you can afford not to do a special year in fellowship training extra year. So I came to California and something sort of, you know, really do something sort of different. But I think that the hardships come, well, you're traveling, you're leaving your family. That was huge because we're very close to both of our families, my wife and I, and they're both in the same area. So to leave them, leave your friends, leave people you grew up with. Because when I started practice here, I knew nobody. I started like zero. If I started practice back where I trained, I knew all the doctors and a lot of friends. And I mean, I would have been busy day one and never looked back. So it was a lot harder to start a practice here because I didn't know anyone. It just took time. I would just put my nose to the grindstone like I sort of always did and was sort of taught to do. And I would go to the emergency rooms. I would talk to the local, you know, docs, introduce myself, do that kind of thing and say, you know, if you have any problems, call me and just make yourself available. In surgery, we say available, affable, and able. That's how you establish yourself. So that just takes a lot of work because your, quote, reputation, your credibility doesn't come easily. You know, and I tell young docs today when they start, I say, look, you know, I've been around for a while. If I kind of make a mistake, I kind of screw up a bit. People say, well, you know, Jacob's had a bad day, you know, kind of thing. If you screw up, that's your whole reputation's gone.
Right.
So you really have to work really hard to make sure you're doing the right thing, you're ethical, you're motivated, you're really live by the book in the sense of being true to yourself and true to your patients. That's a hard thing to do every day.
Right. At what point in time for you, so you were a doctor at UCSF, you were offered a directorship there running the whole department, but you had this idea that you wanted to go out on your own. Tell me a little bit about that crossroads of you having, again, you're being a doctor at a major institution like UCSF, that's like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But for you, it was, you wanted to go into private practice. Tell us a little bit about that whole process.
It was certainly, would have been a feather in my cap, so to speak. And I think that I was very honored to be offered the position of director of facial plastic surgery at UCSF. But for me, you know, I wasn't trying to impress somebody. I wasn't trying to impress them. Just to say that after my name is a credential that, yes, would have been nice, but really I knew that if I did that, I would sort of be shackled because you're an institution. There's politics, there's grants, money, you know, things to do that I personally wasn't that interested in. My interest was to be the best I could be as a surgeon and not sort of worry so much about other things. And that to me was more important. I wanted to prove to myself that I could be the best person I could be as a surgeon. And that wouldn't happen there because there would be so many extraneous things. So it's a harder route to go through because you, again, starting from scratch, and you have to prove yourself. Nobody's saying, okay, you're the director. Because once you're director, you can kind of say lots of things and people believe you because it's like you got that after your name. But that wasn't important to me. You know, it was important for me later for people to say, he made it on his own. He has that reputation because he worked really hard at it.
Mm-hmm. So going back to kind of your craft, your profession, so now you're working at UCSF, you decided your own private practice as a plastic surgeon, and it's great because you know that piece of it, right?
Right.
The bigger piece, I mean, don't get me wrong, being a plastic surgeon, and you got to make sure you're doing good work, right? Because like you said, your reputation's
is
at risk, right? But then there's also the piece, the marketing piece, the running a business piece that they don't teach you in medical school.
Right.
What was that like?
That was really hard.
Yeah, tell us
that,
tell us about
that. Yeah, that was hard because I realized that I joined two docs, and so they were already running a practice. And I would sit back and I'd say, well, are we really running this the best way we can? So I started reading books by Starbucks Got Started and Freakonomics and all, you know, the books that Malcolm Gladwell and later, you know, but lots and lots of books to educate myself on motivation, on business, entrepreneurship. For instance, we would have meetings with our staff and I'd say to my partners in private, I'd say, look, how are we going to motivate our staff? How do we make them better individuals? And they'd say, well, they're fine the way they are. And I'm like, well, no. Well, how do we give a salary? How do we give a bonus? It should be on performance. It wasn't. So I had all these ideas. I eventually we split ways because we didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things. And for me, like when I have people who work with me, I don't just believe that they're my employee. That's not it. It's that they're part of a team. I have respect for them. That way, if I give them respect, I know I'm going to get it. And it's not just somebody I work with. It's a real team that we discuss. I appreciate their input. Doesn't mean I always take it, but they need to know that I value them. So those kind of business things and reading those books and educating myself was very difficult. I mean, there was a period for probably 8-10 years where I was reading more business books probably than I was reading medical books, which I'd been reading, of course, forever. That was really important. I learned a lot of very valuable things about how to run the business, motivate, hire, fire, about California law, with employment, all those things that you really need to do. That was critical.
Hmm. It's interesting. So you had this passion for history. You're an artist. It's a passion. It's something that you love. And the, you know, obviously the business side you had to learn. For someone that's listening right now, let's just say that person's name is Bob. He's 55 years old, drives 2 hours to and from work every day, isn't real fond of his job. I think most people have a passion for something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what advice would you give Bob? Like, he doesn't know what he's going to do, and he's got to continue to work. What advice do you give Bob of there's the passion piece of it, but how to apply the business piece to the passion piece? How does all that work together? What advice would you give him?
Move closer to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that it's a great question. I think we all struggle with that about how to motivate ourselves in general. But say Bob is not, he's doing a job because that's just sort of what he fell into that job, say. Bob has to now say, okay, if I really don't want to do this going forward, I really need to reinvent myself. Honestly, that's what's going to have to happen. They're going to have to say, what am I good at? What am I not good at? What can I focus on that I am good at? Where does my passion really lie? But very logically, that's kind of what I did with this business thing, is to take steps towards that. Read books, educate yourself first. Say he wants to be a carpenter, or he's good at that, or whatever he's good at that he's not doing right now. Maybe it's a hobby, or maybe he's just always wanted to do that. Educate yourself first at that. That's what I tell him. And just study that, read it, be a pro intellectually about that thing, market research. Even if I do that, what kind of money could I make doing that? You have to have steps in place and then have a business plan and formulate that and then slowly take those steps and put them into action while you're still doing the job that you kind of hate, but at least you're going to start this and then you kind of see, well, am I good at that? Is there market, you know, value in that? And if there is, then that's one point you're going to have to make that cut, that jump.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that people should make a jump, or do you think the sidepreneur thing we had talked about, right?
Well,
is that a way to go, or do you recommend?
Well, I it depends, I think, how unhappy they are with what they're doing. Now, obviously, The practical part is that's paying his rent or mortgage or whatever. It depends on how bad somebody's situation is. If they're really, really, really unhappy, and I know a few people like that, and they're doing it, they're going to work, but boy, when I talk to them, they're really unhappy, and I feel bad for them. You really just need to start that way, this sidepreneur, whatever, ship. But I think that at some point, there needs to be a jump. I think you can't do both.
Right.
You can't. You'll just drive yourself crazy. I think you're going to have to make that break. I believe if you jump, the net will appear. I really believe that. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of opportunities that I had today wouldn't have happened if I didn't do that.
Right.
And I would never have known they were going to happen.
Exactly.
If I didn't take the chance.
Right.
I mean, the skincare business that I have, I met people all over the world that I never would have met, and business partners, and these people, and you with TV, and all kinds of different people that I would not have had if I didn't take the risks. You just have to take a risk, but I'm saying it in a calculated way. You don't just sort of jump and do something different. That's just going to lead to failure. When I switched from doing trauma and cancer and all that, and to do completely 100% cosmetic, that was a big leap of faith, because what if the economy did tank and what if people didn't want a facelift? And I would go, oh, when I go back to that, you know, then people say, what happened to you? You know, I just said, you know what? I'm going to make that leap. It worked out, but I didn't just do it willy-nilly. I worked at it, had business plans, built it up on the side. I did do that to kind of get it going, and then made the leap.
Got it. Yeah. And it worked out for you. So fast forward. So I know about 10 years ago, you decided to get into the skincare line. It's interesting because you have the successful private practice going and you decide, okay, now I got to make this investment. I need to go out and raise funds to do this thing. And that comes with a whole extra set of bag of headaches and worries, right? Because you're having to go out and get people to become essentially business partners with you. Mm-hmm, What was the thought process behind then going off and starting your own skincare line? Why did you decide to do it?
I decided to do it because I had an opportunity, and the opportunity presented myself, and I realized this kind of opportunity is not going to happen again. And somebody came to me who was a famous cosmetic chemist, worked for Estee Lauder for many years, and developed many famous products that are on the shelf today. And he left, and he's looking for somebody to partner with. If I had turned that down, I think that would have been kind of foolish. And the other part was that, as you mentioned, I have an interest in Egyptology. So at the same time, there was this molecule that we wanted to bring into the skincare fold. Those kind of things, I think, as Steve Jobs would say in his famous talk about, you look back in your life, there's these steps. You may not know that, but there are steps actually ahead of you. You just need to go and walk on them, but they will come there. They will appear. That's the same thing with me. It's like, okay, there's this chemist. There's this Egyptian molecule thing. This is kind of crazy because this is, what are the chances of that happening kind of at the same time? And I took a risk and I went to people, some family friends, but also other people that weren't in my family. And I said, this is what we have. Yes, it's risky, we're a startup, but we really believe in this product, Stanley Jacobs MD skincare line and this serum, and we had science. We were kind of building up to this point where we knew that we would have to have science behind it. So there was a credibility factor obviously built in. But once we knew that and we had some science, that's when we really knew we could push forward.
That's awesome. That's great. So I know you've got the skincare line. You're looking to get into other markets here. So you've got plenty of things going on in your life. I also know exercise. You know, we were with you as part of our video that we're going to be producing with you. You're at the gym working out like crazy. How does exercise, fitness, nutrition, wellness, how does all that play into your success?
Well, first of all, you probably don't want to go to facial plastic surgeon that looks like, you know, he's not very healthy.
Yeah, right.
You know, you don't want to go to a cardiologist that's overweight. So that's part of it. But I was lucky enough when I was growing up to be pretty athletic and played football and hockey, lots of things. But, and of course, during medical school residency, I didn't have a chance to do any of that. So then I became really not very fit at all, and then realized that I really had to get my act together because I was operating and I noticed my back was sore, my neck was sore. This was back when I was in my 40s. And I realized, well, what am I going to do when I'm 60? I'm going to fall apart. And so I got a trainer. I got fit, I got healthy, and it's the best thing I ever did. I couldn't live without it. I mean, it's motivating and it's on itself, on its own. I get a lot more energy. People tell me all the time, you know, we're operating now 5 o'clock in the evening, 6 o'clock, and they're looking at me like, are you okay, kind of thing? And I'm going, yeah, this is great, I'm just going. And they're like, I can't believe that you're still going the way you were at 10 o'clock in the morning. That's the reality, is that you got to keep going. And I think you also get mentally fatigued if you're physically fatigued, right?
Right.
We all know that. So if you're getting physically tired, your brain cells aren't going to be as active. I mean, your serotonin, all those catecholamines, all those things are not going to be moving and getting going. For me, that's in itself sort of self-perpetuating.
Yeah. You have as much energy as anybody I know that's 30 years old, but you're 61 years old. You're not a puppy anymore, right?
Yeah.
And you still, like, watch you this morning working out. You get after it. My hat's off to you for continuing to do that at 61.
I don't think it should be an option for people. I don't think exercise should be an option. I don't mean like you go through your life, well, I could either work out or I can't, or I don't have to. I think it should be like everybody should think of it as a non-option. It should just be part of your life. You get up, you go to the bathroom, you know, it's not an option. You eat, it's not an option. And I think the hardest part for people, again, is to carve out that time. So years ago when I started, I'm like, well, where am I going to put it? I'm busy here. I got meetings. It's like, no, I got to rearrange my schedule. I got to do something to make a time for me to do this. And once I had a time slot, then now we're cooking.
It's interesting, on my job, people will say, well, like, what's your typical day? Like, what time do you start? What time do you guys end? Whatever. And I say, well, you know, I usually start 6:30, 6:45. Mm-hmm. And like, well, that's, you know, you start early. Well, I'm at the gym at 6:30, 6:45. And to me, it's part of my job. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And fortunately, I do work for a company that also believes in wellness and fitness and that being part of what you do. But it has become part of my job. And that's how I treat it. It's not like a 10-hour or 11-hour day. It's a 12-hour day because that extra hour in the gym, right?
Yeah, so, but you're going to live longer because of that.
You're going to live longer,
you're going to be healthier.
Yeah, and happier too. I have a very, very good friend. We talked about like fitness. And if you know you're going to die at a certain age, regardless of what you do, you're going to die at this fixed age. Mm-hmm. I would rather die at the same age, if you're smoking, drinking, or doing all those kinds of things and just not feeling great, or die at that same time but feel great because I took the time to work out and exercise. And that plays obviously a big role in it. I guess one of the last things for you is just in terms of what's your passion, what's your inspiration, what keeps you going every single day? Like, is there any one thing? You also have a philanthropic side to you as well. Mm. You're not going to retire, and at some point in time, you want to give back. Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned doing things in third world countries and teaching them how to perform minor surgeries and do things. Tell me a little bit about that. Why is that important, and how does that play into the part of the passion piece of the circle? What keeps you going?
The third world country thing, I think, you know, my family background is Iran and India, and I've never been. I mean, I was born there, but I've just never been there, really. It's like going back to the roots kind of thing, but it could be applied to any country, really. But I think we live in a very privileged world. I'm doing elective surgery. People don't really have to have it. They're not dying. I love what I do. They really appreciate what I'm doing. It's all great. Like I was saying, I love what I do. But I also have the science background. We go into medicine because we're empathetic. We care. We want to make a difference. And I have made a difference in people's lives. It does change their life, which is great. And that's one of the real motivating things to do. When somebody says to you, you know what, I just got a dozen roses from a woman a couple of days ago. It wasn't for Valentine's. Yeah. It was just that she said it's a year anniversary since you did my facial surgery, facelift, and so on. She says, I can't believe how much of a difference it's meant to me, and I want to thank you so much. It's just one of the best things I ever did. That kind of thing is just makes you feel fantastic.
Yeah.
And we hear that all the time. And I tell patients, that's the best part of my job.
Yeah.
That is the best part of my job.
Yeah.
Actually, not even doing the surgery. to see that look in their face and that eyes and how they change their dress and their mannerisms because they feel better about themselves, can't put a price on that. And that is incredibly motivating. That just makes you feel great inside. So that sort of feeling good inside thing, which motivates me now, it's that kind of thing now translating to an impoverished country.
Sure.
And I think to give back is really important. And I've been very privileged to start from nothing but build to quite a nice living. And I think to take that money that I have and I've accumulated and not just sort of maybe sail around the world or something, but use that money to start these kind of small, like a triage sort of outpost, if you will, in these rural communities. Because that's the problem, is that disease sort of happens small, gets big, and then by the time that happens, they try to go to tertiary center there. It doesn't work. They're going to die or whatever. So to teach young people how to sew, how to set a bone, how to diagnose and listen to a heart and lungs, kind of basic stuff. But if you imagine if you had hundreds and hundreds of those people all over these underdeveloped countries in the rural areas, the medicine and the health in general would just dramatically improve, because now they don't walk around with a festering infection because they didn't know what to do. And now they have to have amputation.
Sure.
You could have saved a leg kind of thing. So that's, you know, it's a bit of a Robin Hood kind of a thing, but it's almost like I feel like I was meant to do that. I was privileged enough and God sort of allowed me to do this, to have a great thing in my life. You know, I need to do something with that.
Sure, and give back. This is great. Is there anything else you want to add? Am I missing anything?
Well, I think, you know, you never know where inspiration is going to come from. We all know that. And I think the more you put yourself out there to say an opportunity or an idea, for instance, I like to travel. What I'm saying is that you meet people that are different walks of life.
Sure.
Maybe that would open up for certain people, oh, you know what, I want to learn a language. Well, learning that language, it opens up another opportunity because, hey, there's another guy that wants to have a business that's with this language. Or, you never know. And I think if you stay at home and you stay quiet on your Chesterfield kind of thing and you don't venture, nothing venture, nothing gain is absolutely true. You have to put yourself out there. You have to always be, I think you have to have your radar out too, right? You have to be thinking that, is this an opportunity? Is that an opportunity? Is that, you know, what's interesting, you need to read, you need to educate yourself, whether it's reading entrepreneur books or Wall Street Journal. I don't care what it is. You've got to read though. That's really important. You've got to read something that will tweak you. There's things that will suddenly pop up that you wouldn't have realized. Hey, that's interesting. That may drive you to an area that you would never have thought about before. So radar up, reading all the time, educating yourself, and then hopefully, you know, things will sort of come into place.
That's wonderful. And how could people find out about you? Can you give them their website? And also, where can they find out about your skincare line?
Well, we have two websites. One is stanleyjacobsmd.com, which is the skincare site, and the other one's Dr. Stanley Jacobs, which is the plastic surgery site. So if you just Google my name, you'll find both Stanley Jacobs. They can find all kinds of information on that.
That's great. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You're welcome. It's great.
Hope you enjoyed this podcast. For more information on all our guests, go to brand50.com, where you'll find show notes, podcasts, and other resources to help guide you through your next phase. Please consider subscribing to our show on iTunes and do us a favor and write us a review while you're there. You can also follow our Brand 50 Facebook page. Thanks for listening.